This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 68, Scraping the Web. This week, we're pleased to bring you an interview with Andy Thimer. Andy runs a startup company that aggregates recipes from all over the web. We'll hear from Andy about some of the tools and techniques that they use. Let's listen to the interview. Hi, this is Larry. I'm here with my friend Andy. Andy, can you introduce yourself?
Sure, Larry. My name is Andy Thimer, and I'm working with several startup companies here in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin area. One of the startups is a company called LanceAir that does data aggregation for the financial services insurance industry, annuities and life insurance aggregation of data.
And that's your day job, right?
That is my day job.
That's where, like, after we're done recording here, you're going to go and you got to work all day.
That's where I got to go.
But you do other things, and one of the things that we're going to talk about is your side project.
My side project, we started up a business partner and I that met at a former startup company about a year ago, and actually how I met you, Larry, through Bill. But we started
it was 2 years ago, by the way.
2 years ago.
Wow.
All right.
It
has been a while already.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. When the first iPhone came out. And,
right.
Yeah.
That's how I've actually met Billy. So.
Yep. Yep. I think he's finally got me convinced to get an iPhone, too. So.
Oh, wait till the end of the show. You'll be on Windows Mobile, buddy.
All right. All right. We'll wait and see. But we put our heads together, and from our previous startup days, fired up a new startup that we just launched in March that is a recipe aggregator. So cooking recipes on the internet. You go to Food Network, All Recipes, Epicurious, all the different sites out there.
There's a lot of different sites.
And there's a lot.
Yeah.
Yep. 10 new ones every week, I'm told. So
really?
Yeah. So you can go to one site, recipebridge.com, and search all of those sites. And it makes it very quick and easy to find any recipe on the internet.
So we're going to talk about that. But before we get off you too much, you're passionate about startups. You know, we heard that you've, you've got several startup going, right? It's you're one of those entrepreneurial guys. You've got a passion for that. You were actually featured on a magazine recently, right? On the cover?
Absolutely. In Milwaukee here, Magazine Soho, with several other young entrepreneurs that are in the city trying to change things, trying to build a community around the younger entrepreneurs and get everybody together that are interested in starting up companies. And part of that, too, I work at the Technology Innovation Center, which is a big building. Used to be a tuberculosis hospital and a mental asylum, but the county has given it over to cheap rent where the entrepreneurs can hang out and jam together.
Oh, that's interesting. interesting history. And one of my goals is there's three of you on the cover of that magazine.
Yep.
I'm going to wind up getting all three of you guys
on
the show.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Because I think you guys all have it. And I know two of you guys, and I don't know the third guy, but you guys have all got interesting things to say. So at some point or another, we'll talk about that magazine cover several times. But it's you also were featured recently in Inc. magazine, you got to mention there.
Yeah, in the March issue of Inc. magazine, it was featured an article discussing outsourced programming. And along the lines of Recipe Bridge, a lot of the coding was done by an outsourced C#.NET programmer. A lot of our spiders and the extraction tools that we use to tag and pull information from the web. So I was talking a little bit about that and some of the best practices that I found in trying to audit and find good coders that can be used for projects on the Rent-A-Coder, Guru, and those sites.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting model. I mean, I have 10 ideas a week for, the next great social network or next great this or great, great that. And my problem is always, like, the time to actually build something, right? Because, like you, I have a day job, working for Microsoft, and that day job is like on the 50 to 60 hour a week kind of thing. So it doesn't leave a lot of time at night to do a lot of extra side work kind of stuff. And this model is interesting because you are basically paying somebody to help build your site. And it's almost like piecework, right? Because you don't get involved in a long-term consulting contract, right?
Right. And actually found the best way to get success out of those types of projects are very short, smaller projects. You know, some people try and architect the whole master website or the whole application in one shot, and it really doesn't work when you're dealing with an outsourced coder. And I went through that process and learned firsthand how that didn't work. And nowadays, we just kind of keep the flow, a few hundred dollars, going into the project for every iteration, and it works so much better.
Well, and that's how all software should be built, right?
Yep.
You know, a couple of features at a time.
Yep.
Right? And what that allows you to do is receive the ROI from what's been built and use that to fund future things.
Right, right.
You know, it's a daunting task to say, okay, we're going to build X site and we're not going to get any ROI until we're done, right?
Yeah.
So it's really nice to add features. And I think that that's kind of where, you know, good software development's going. And you see methodologies like Scrum doing that anyway.
Yeah, I totally couldn't agree with you more. We do the same thing on Raspi Bridge. It's, you know, I guess very 37 Signals, Basecamp, those folks down in Chicago. But, you know, people ask us for features that are pretty basic that we still haven't added to the site because we just focus on the search right now, and we can always roll in new features. So
you want to talk about the technology behind it? Oh, sure. No, it was one thing I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
BizSpark.
Oh, yeah. The BizSpark program, I found that right away when the program was released, and it's been a pretty cool thing for us. In the startups that I work with, and there's, I think, 10 different startups on the floor that my company and my office is located in the research center, and we were able to sign up one of our consulting companies as a BizSpark partner. So we were doing consulting for different startup companies and helping them with different aspects, marketing, legal, and had hooked up with the BizSpark program right away. And Recipe Bridge is a member of that, but it's been great because all of our licenses, all of our MSDN subscription access, everything's been free, and it's allowed us to develop a lot of our apps.
And we talked about startups using Microsoft technology about a year and a half ago on the show. So I don't think we've actually talked much about BizSpark. At the time, the program was called Empower, and we actually talked to a company in Chicago called Canopy Financial that was part of the program.
Okay.
The concept is the same, is that, you know, you as a startup can get, I think it's a couple of years.
Three, I think.
Oh, yep. So like 3 years access to the premium developer suites from
Pretty
Microsoft.
Much everything, yeah.
And it's not like, you know, if you had a 1,000-person company, it's not going to really work for you because I think that there's a limited number of licenses. But it's meant to bootstrap the companies and have them become successful on the Microsoft platform. And then when they're big and they're famous, then, you know, they're going to go license the software from us anyway. So, and it's more than just the software, though, although that's a key benefit, you know, because there's actually support with marketing and, you know, there's a whole program around that that gives you a little more value-added things. But I thought that, you know, since you mentioned that you were part of the BizSpark program, we would give it a patented thirsty developer shameless plug.
No, that's great. No, it's been fantastic, actually. I've gotten several of the other startup companies in our wing to sign up for it, and, you know, everybody's developing and using different databases, and why not upgrade from Access to MS SQL as long as it's right there? So,
yeah, and it certainly makes the cost equation a lot simpler.
Oh.
You know, because when you're
especially, I mean, these are all 3-4 person companies, like you said. So
yeah. When you're bootstrapping, you know, every dollar counts. So, you know, 5 MSDN licenses is, you know, that's thousands of dollars worth of software that's being provided.
Well, the people wouldn't do it. I mean,
right.
They just wouldn't buy it. So I think it's a great move by Microsoft. And actually was at a startup weekend event down in Chicago a couple weeks ago and heard a lot of good feedback from some of the investment advisors that were floating around the event. And had, you know, we're really appreciating that, and heard a lot of good feedback from them that it was one of the better programs Microsoft's throwing out there to encourage entrepreneurs. So
yeah, that's excellent.
It's kudos.
It's got a lot of buzz considering that it only officially launched, I think, about October of last year.
Okay,
so it's not even a year into it. And granted, a lot of the principles were there in the Empower program, so it's not like the concept's new. But BizSpark really streamlined it with the concept of the network partners. But enough about BizSpark. Let's talk about technology. So you have the audacious goal of finding every recipe on the internet and putting it in an aggregation site where people can go to.
That's it.
Because we mentioned earlier that it's kind of siloed, right? That I can go to a lot of different websites and pick up recipes. And you mentioned some of the big ones like Food Network, and I'm a big fan of the Food Network.
Okay.
My wife and I probably watch a couple of hours of Food Network a week.
So you're in the kitchen with the laptop and
No, we're in front of the couch.
You're in front of the couch.
Eating takeout Chinese food, talking about how we should be cooking our own food. But you know, we like the shows that get involved in the personalities, you know, like the Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives and the Ace of Cakes guy, right?
Yeah.
So we're big fans of that, but we do spend a lot of time on their website, which is a nice companion to the actual broadcast network. I think that they're one of the companies that have really done the internet right, you know, making the internet a destination, but as well as it's a great companion. So when I see Paula Deen cooking something on one of her shows, I can go to the website and find the recipe. What I don't get is the other recipes that are on some other site that might be similar to that. So if I'm looking for a specific recipe on Food Network, it's fantastic. I would go there. If I am looking for just general, like, show me all enchilada recipes, that's what Recipe Bridge is for, right?
Right. One of the things that we found is that we'd be going from Food Network to Epicurious to All Recipes to all the other sites, and we'd end up at Google or MSN and be searching for
Bing.
There you go. And you'd be just searching, and you spend 15, 20 minutes searching for one recipe to cook. And I think for people, and especially the younger generation out there that maybe didn't grow up learning to cook for mom or learning to cook they want to cook, they're used to the instant gratification of search, find. And right now, there's not a good solution for that out there because it's so fragmented, as you mentioned. So,
right. And we'll talk about the longer term aspects of, like, the semantic web, which is the Web 3.0. It's almost become like a joke in and of itself, right?
Yeah.
Because it seems like we're always 6 months away from the semantic web, and I think we'll always be 6 months away from it. But you really, I mean, in a perfect web, Recipe Bridge wouldn't have to exist because, you know, you could just say, web, show me all the recipes, and it would do that for you. But
right.
We're living in an imperfect web. But let's talk about how you, from a technology standpoint, how you actually are what I like to call scouring the web.
Yeah, we've actually, there's two parts to our recipebridge.com website, and that's really the application, the website, and our spiders on the back end. And we've actually chosen to separate the two. Unlike a Google or maybe a bigger network, we've separated off the spidering tools 100%. So the spidering tools are all built on C#.NET platform, and the application is all open source, PHP, MySQL, a little bit of Java in the background. And the reason we did that is because the data is so unstructured that we had to have an automated and a semi-automated process. So a lot of the recipes that we pull in are looked at by a human in many cases because there's just so many different variants of ingredients, formats, blogs, all the different sites that we pull from. And there's just no way to create a catch-all for them right now because the information is so messed up all the time. So part of it is a browser-assisted tool that allows users to view and extract and pull information back and kind of be able to guide the spider down the paths to get the right information. And then the other one has some logic that knows what an ingredient set of ingredients typically looks like, what directions typically look like, and to be able to pull that information together. So,
and that's one of the things is that I didn't appreciate when you first told me about this, like, a while ago, you know, the scale that you were talking about, because it's obvious to go to the sites that have a nice structure, but your audacious goal is every recipe. So if I post a recipe on my blog, you ought to be able to aggregate it and find it, particularly if I'm a blogger about food, right?
Right, right.
And you told me an interesting story about you actually had bloggers contacting you to opt into this.
Right.
They're like, hey, you know, I want to be part of this.
Yeah, no, it's been a fantastic success. In fact, we had, driven by one of our partners, a celebrity chef down in Australia, drove, I think, 25 bloggers in yesterday afternoon to actually...
Yesterday afternoon,
submitted their site to be indexed and have their recipes added to the site. And that's one of the great things is that there's so many great little recipes out there on sites. You know, a site dedicated to watercress recipes, sites dedicated to appetizer recipes, sites dedicated to cooking with, you know, a certain type of pepper, that they're all there. And a lot of times you'll never see them with Google or any other search engine because they're so buried and there's so much noise in the cooking space. So
yeah, and I have a niece that is highly allergic to a number of things, and that's part of the niche there is, like, you know, cooking around allergies, right?
Yeah, what's she allergic to?
A lot of things.
Okay.
And it's tough on her mom, you know,
yep,
to deal with that because she has a combination and, you know, of allergies. But there are little niche things that'll talk about that. And I won't use her as the example, but
yeah,
dairy and gluten, for instance,
sure,
right? If you're allergic to both of those, that really cuts out a lot of recipes.
Right.
You know, we got an idea for the scale, right? And you actually talked about a lot of this is opt-in. And one of the things, just to, like, you know, cover off on this thing, you know, you're not... necessarily, you know, there are people that are nefarious about scraping the web.
Yep.
And do nefarious things. You always link back to the original site, right? You give the content, you know, owner full credit, right?
Right. We're focused on search.
Right.
And our goal is just to make an engine that makes it very, very quick to find recipes across the internet, across the site. So just like an Indeed.com will do for jobs, where right. it's a vertical search engine where users can search many different job sites from one search at Indeed. We do the same thing for recipes. So we're always giving link credit. You know, we see how many sites, the popular sites, and we're basically sending traffic to these sites, and nobody's had an issue.
Right. And I just wanted to make sure that we cover that off, that there are people that do nefarious things with spiders. And you use the term spider, and I didn't have you define it at the time. So describe your spider, or just in general, what is a spider?
My definition of a spider would probably be what Recipe Bridge isn't. My definition of a spider would be a tool that goes through and does a bit of auto-discovery and learns how to actually adapt and find its way through an entire site, whether it's via robots.txt or a sitemap or by doing content recognition and following patterns. We actually, our spiders, if you call them, and we call them spiders just for the, I guess, easy sake of naming them those, are more, they're templated, I guess, is a better way to say it. So there's a human programming and telling the spider what it's looking for in most cases, and then it goes through and does more extraction than it probably does actual spidering. So we tell it what it's looking for, and then it goes out and finds it. So it's not very smart. It's a dumb spider.
Yeah, it's spiders are, well, actually, it's dumb in some ways, and it's smart in other ways, right? Because what a typical spider that we think of as a search engine starts at the top of the site, looks for links that it can discover,
right.
Follows them down, taking hints. And we'll talk about robots and site config and sitemap in a second, I think. But, it's doing a follow kind of thing and grabbing all the text. Yours is specific with – it's smarter that the fact that it's got the template that it's actually looking for. Now, of course, it can fail if the template doesn't match, right?
Right.
How do you start? Do you a basic thing looking for, you know, a site that has a lot of the instances of the word recipe or something like that?
No, actually recipe is one of the words that gets thrown out, because it's way too overused. So it tends to be a stop word. Yeah.
Cause we use the word, recipe in software a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
which is a dumb application.
Many other things.
Yeah.
But the great thing about the cooking space is there are so many words that are very unique, measurements, different types of cooking styles. So by building a big database of those types of terms right from the get-go, we've been able to create a pretty solid way of finding the pages that actually contain recipe content. And once we get to that point, it becomes fairly trivial.
Then let loose the spiders.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's all right. It's all right. Can I get a recording of that so I can put it on the opening of the program?
All right. It might wind up in the bloopers.
Excellent, yeah.
I'll get you a cut of that, though.
It's worked out really, really well, and it goes back to something both Bill and I learned at our first startup, and Bill is my business partner on this project, and that was really that a fully automated process has just so many fail points, and it requires such an IT staff to start it up that, especially as a startup and bootstrapped company, and two guys that are doing this for 8 hours after their initial 8-hour day,
right.
It's so much to manage, and it would be a tremendous expense to build a 100% automated solution. Money can fix it. I think, you know, a few sharp guys out there could fix it and do it pretty easily.
I don't know. The web is pretty broken from a structure standpoint.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that.
No.
But, you know, it's, you know, you can get closer to 100%, but it's one of those, it's like an integral in calculus that you were never going to get there.
Yeah.
You know, theoretically, you can get closer. And like you said, it's an investment for each percentage point that you get closer
it
to
is.
Or each probably tenth of a percentage point, right?
Right.
And it comes to the point where it's like, well, this just isn't worth it. I can throw people at this problem, right?
Yeah, well, no, it's a good problem, a good point. So,
because people are really good at seeing structure and unstructured data, right?
Yep.
And I think that's the whole basis of your template, right?
And there's lots of sites that we've talked to and we're friends with that do just that. It's, you'd be surprised, but they have the manual research centers that are verifying and pulling content. And, yeah, the natural thing is, I can do that with technology. But a lot of times, you're right. It's exactly that. It's just simpler to do it by hand. So
your spiders, you've probably got a frequency that they're going to visit, you know, sites. Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about the technology for that.
I mean, sure. again, not really too much exciting there. It's pretty standard fare. The spider, when it goes through a site and looks for it, we have it set at a certain interval, which the great thing about recipes is they don't time out. So a recipe today is as good as a recipe a month from now. Yeah. So unlike jobs or other things that are very timely, we don't have as much of an issue with things deleting and falling off or expiring. So we're really only looking for new content. So we have our spiders set to do an auto discovery check once a month. And that's probably too often. Quite honestly, at the rate recipes appear, it probably would make sense to do it more 3 to 4 months easily, because generally once a database is built, they're only adding maybe 10, 15 new recipes a month, I would say, on average. You know, there's exceptions, but
I actually got a funny story about this. One of my favorite recipes, and I bake on occasion. I do a banana bread.
Okay.
And it's Todd's Wonder Bread. And I had a fear the last time because I couldn't find it, you know, with a search. And I had never printed it out. I hadn't, you know, I could tell you what the ingredients are, but I probably couldn't tell you the proportions correctly.
Yeah.
And every time that I wanted to bake this, and I bake it about once a month, right, Todd's Wonder Bread, I would just go out and search for it. And it was always there. And
yeah.
I got this, like, sense of panic when it wasn't there. And I found it eventually. It had creeped to the second page, or, you know, I had to add some extra keywords to it or something.
Right.
But you're right. Recipes, unlike job listings, unlike events, you know, some of the other things that you would want to aggregate on the web, are pretty fresh and have a long life.
Yep. Yeah, that's been one of the – I guess it was a hidden benefit. We didn't really think about that too much going in. But having gone in, it's one of the things that saved us a lot of money probably on the technology side, not having to have a real efficient solution for dealing with fall off. So – we've gotten a bit lucky there, but it's pretty much just a scheduled part of our spider that does the auto discovery. Once it knows what it's looking for on a given site, it's just a check to see if the pages have changed drastically or if content has changed drastically.
And these are just C# programs, or they run like at the command line almost, or
Command line, or they're actually, most of them are desktop applications. So,
oh really?
We like to have the user somewhat involved in.
Just on the templating.
Every part of it. So
okay.
By creating the template, and they can certainly be run on a command line, and they are in certain cases, but in general, we like to have them up and running and just have separate machines that we can monitor.
Yeah.
Well, again, we're bootstrapped, so our spiders run out of our houses for the most part right now. So we just have a separate terminal off to the side that we can watch and oversee processes, both myself here and Bill on the East Coast.
Well, that's pretty cool. You know, so standard C# stuff, I bet you're just doing HTTP, you know, request objects on at a system.net, I believe it is.
Yep.
I should know that better, but I
didn't write it, so sure. It sounds good to me.
And that's the, I think a lot of people, you know, don't understand that there are libraries in .net where you could, and don't do this, nobody who's listening to the show, you could write your own browser just with the low-level libraries that are there.
Yep.
The complicated part is not the actual network requests, and we'll talk about this in a second here. It's parsing and making sense of the markup that comes back. And fortunately, you're not having to deal with rendering the stuff.
Right.
You're just capturing the information, right? So you want to know, like, what's the name of the recipe? What's the cook time? What's the temperature set at? What's the list of ingredients? And it's interesting that we actually had an example of a recipe database that somebody built using SQL Server 2008 on the show.
Okay.
So maybe we should quit talking about technology and start talking more about recipes.
Yeah, the popular topic.
He actually said it's like the recipe is a pretty simple data type.
It really is.
I mean, the list of ingredients, you know, can vary, but the types of measurements are pretty well known.
It speaks to something that's been a really good helper for us in the technology side and being able to tag and extract the content. In that is, just like I mentioned, once you have a database of all the popular cooking keywords, you can identify, you know, kind of like a heat map, you can identify concentrations of those really quick. I mean, a block of ingredients has the word cup, tablespoon, teaspoon, you know, all those in a high concentrated area of text, and it makes it pretty easy to figure out where on the page that is.
Yeah, I bet you the only place that you would wind up accidentally going with those keywords is a place that sells cooking stuff.
That's
right?
True. That's true.
And while you're there, it's like sign them up as an advertiser, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And we're not going to get into the monetization of your site.
No, we're a web startup. That's, Not necessary.
So, yeah, chances are you're not making any money on this.
No,
especially if you look at the time you put into it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, no, we're hoping that we can strike up a strategic partnership with somebody that has a lot of traffic in the demographic. Women, actually, I think the stat is almost even women to men visiting cooking sites these days. So, just like you mentioned, it's pretty even. So.
Interesting.
Yeah. I can't side it one way or another, but yeah, there's some opportunity there from a revenue side. It's new. It's something different. You know, there's really no other site out there doing the whole vertical search on the recipe space. So,
in typical startup fashion, you'll deal with that later, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well,
so you mentioned a couple of things that I want to talk about I wouldn't necessarily encourage people, unless you've got like this great startup thing, you got a niche. That scouring the web is basically something you want to spend all your day doing.
Right.
I mean, you guys have obviously put a lot of work into this, and there's a lot of technology, and you've realized a lot of things with that. But you mentioned a couple of things that, you know, if you are having to hit things, knowing these things is good facts. One of them is robots.txt. So tell us really quick, what is a robots.txt?
Sure. The robots.txt essentially tells traditional search engines, typically, and anybody else that's coming into the site, it's sort of an set of instructions for what can and can't be viewed and what can and can't be looked at and saved and cached. In most sites, actually, I shouldn't say that. Most sites you would think would have it. A lot of sites still don't have it. In fact, some of the biggest cooking sites out there don't even have a robots.txt enforced. So
I would actually, I would correct your statement and just scratch out cooking.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sites that don't have robots.txt.
Yeah.
And it's such a simple thing. And for everybody who's listening, you know, go to whatever site that you already got up in your browser. Go to the root of the domain. So in the case of my blog, eraser and crowbar.com, and you just do /robots.txt. And if they have a file, it'll show up. There's a good chance whatever site you're on, you're going to get a 404 on that.
Yep.
Because there's a lot of sites that don't have it. It's almost like it's too easy to forget.
It really is. I don't know. There's not really a noticeable benefit either. And I think that's why a lot of people just ignore it, because it, unlike a sitemap or some other topics that come up, you know, a sitemap helps, you know, all the major search engines you can submit your sitemap to, and it gives them a direct path to all of your content. Robots.txt is, there's not really a benefit for the webmaster there in my mind.
Well, it does solve one thing, that is that if you got a part of your site that you wouldn't want crawled, just because it may not make sense.
Right.
Right. Don't think of it as a security mechanism, because guess what? You're not being secure just because it's not being crawled. But there's a lot of parts of your site that, you know, it might be duplicate content from something that you do want crawled.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's a good way just to say, hey, don't even crawl this. It's out there for some other reason. It's also a good hint, you know, to the website about what they should do, you know, on the site, and whether they should, you know, follow links and how deep they should go and all that. I do think there's the investment in having a robots.txt that matches what you want to do with your site. The investment, the time it takes to put a text file together,
yeah,
that generally is like maybe 10 lines.
Not long, know. Yeah.
It's something that I've been wanting to do on my blog, is to actually say, hey, don't forget about the robots.txt. But robots.txt is like old school throwback. The reason it's a text file is that at the time, pretty much that's what people knew how to deal with.
Right.
This goes back to the early days of the web. There's a modern version of this called the sitemap. And the sitemap, unlike the robots.txt, doesn't have to have a specific name. It could be on a number of different places on the site. And it's like you said, it's something that you tell the search engines where my sitemap config mm-hmm. is. But tell me what it is.
Yeah, it's basically an XML file that allows you to tell search engines specifically, to your point about discovering content, but how often content changes, the frequency, the last date of it was updated, also the title, and then also the exact URL. And it gives you, it doesn't give you a full hierarchy, I don't believe, but in a flat fashion, it allows you to just expel all the, in the example of our site, we're able to display numerous top 10 lists and different types of landing pages that we create for recipes that all lead back and help us for SEO reasons. And that's really the big bonus for sitemaps. I guess that's, you know, protecting content doesn't excite me a whole lot.
Right.
And
making it easier to find
content. But making it easier to find the content.
Does excite you.
And letting Google know exactly how often things are changing.
Bing.
It does reassure me.
We say Bing on the show.
I'm sorry. I know.
When you say Google, you mean search engines.
I mean all search engines, yes.
Yes. And actually, because all, and that's important to note here, is all three major search engines, Yahoo, I almost said live, Bing, and Google, they all support the same format.
Yep.
And that was a big hallelujah of about 2 years ago that all three of them agreed that, hey, we're going to have the same one. We're not going to make the webmasters do three different things based on the search engine, because that would have just been onerous. So I think there's actually an RFC specification that describes the sitemap.
I think so,
The XML structure of it. And then you do go to the individual webmaster tools and all the search engines and say, hey, here's where mine is. And it's a fantastic hint. If your site is not showing up or parts of your site's not showing up, I tell people, it's like the first thing you should do is, you know, do you know what a sitemap is? Go put a static one together and submit it and see what it does.
Yeah, there's a site I've used several times that generates the sitemap for you on the fly, and it'll just download it, and you go in and remove their tags that they've tacked into your sitemap because they throw a couple gratuitous links in there for their service.
Shameless plug.
But I think if you search for free XML sitemap generator, you'll find a couple different tools out there that can make it pretty easy to build that sitemap. So,
and see, that's actually the really cool thing about this is that this is an XML file that sits somewhere on your web server, right? So I tell people, like, just start off with a static one. Take the hierarchy of your site, submit it, and see if you get better results.
Yep.
I know Bing does this. I'm not sure if Google does this, that if your sitemap is kind of rich, it'll actually, in the search results, actually show you the hierarchy.
So
if you type in the name of your company, first result, it'll actually have the categories, the major categories in your sitemap, you know, listed right there in the search engine results. So you get a feel for the actual site itself.
Yeah. So, on that topic, I know we use the live webmaster tools. Have they changed with Bing? And do I need to go resubmit all my site information?
You know, I can't say for sure, but I don't think that they would. They've migrated everything over.
Okay.
Double check. I think we'll put a link in the show notes for the webmaster tools. For Bing.
Yeah.
I keep wanting to say live.
Well, I know Live had them. I haven't gone and looked to see if they rebranded the Webmaster Tools yet either. But.
I don't know that. But we'll put a link in the show notes for that.
Right on.
Back to the whole thing, the whole concept of you can dynamically generate the sitemap config.
Yep.
So you could actually have the endpoint not be a file sitting on your web server. You could actually have that be a web service that hits your database for the results and dynamically generates it for the search engines.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's a great plugin we use for the blog, which is a WordPress blog that does that very thing, just regenerates based on your database, just like you said, as a web service.
So when you add a post it's even more valuable, like if you're tagging stuff.
Yep. Yep.
You know, and I would think that, you know, from a recipe standpoint, you want to tag things, you know, with a number of different, you know, keywords. Right.
Yep.
The style of the food, you know, you could probably do some really cool things. And you might already have thought of this, right? Like tag recipes that are under 10 minutes to make.
Yep.
For the guys like me. That.
Well, and also with, you know, a certain number of ingredients, you know, that number of ingredients that it takes to put the recipe together is one of, I think, especially for the single guy. Or the guy that's trying to cook out of leftovers in the fridge, or the four things that he has sitting around, is something that we've heard from actually both men and women to be extremely useful, and especially nowadays too, saving time and money, using up everything you have,
right.
Making things that maybe not as conventional, but using up all those ingredients and foods that you have leftovers. So, being able to target things that have four ingredients, seven ingredients, and maybe the primary ingredient's chicken is something that we've worked really hard to build a solution for as well.
So last topic I want to cover, just a couple minutes on, we can't stress enough at how unstructured web pages are, right? Like if I start a recipe blog and once a week I'm going to put stuff out, I may not even have consistency on my own blog. Forget about other blogs. Right. So there's probably somebody out there thinking, listening to the show right now, like, you know, is there a standard data format, like an XML, you know, style of format? And you mentioned this before we started recording, so it's a softball question.
Yeah. No, there is a format that the Europeans have tried to put together called Recipe XML. Pretty brilliant naming convention there. But
obvious. Right?
Yeah. But the problem with that is it just hasn't made very much progress, and I think the 5-6 years since it was originally put forth, it tends to sit in educational Hades, and it hasn't been approved by anybody. Nobody in the States is using it, and it really isn't used on any site out there, yet it exists. I mean, as you mentioned too, the format is pretty simple, but I think, and you mentioned this, you know, before the show as well. Was it the micro tagging or
micro formats?
And the tagging really lends itself probably better to recipes because there's so many different, I guess, combinations of ingredients lead to a certain type of cooking style. You know, certain number of ingredients lead to a difficulty of a particular recipe.
Right.
Cook times plus an ingredient. There's so many different ways to mash things together that I think a tagging approach is probably a smarter approach than a straight XML format at this point. So
yeah, and the beauty of micro formats, and we did a show with this, Pete Perdell, you know, from Milwaukee was on the show with us. The beauty of micro formats is that it's part of the web page itself.
Yeah.
Which is what you're seeing, you know, with your spider and what's what I'm seeing with my eyes. An XML feed would have to be a separate call.
Right.
And that's, you know, and that kind of like you have a dual maintenance thing. You have the presentation that the XML consumer would have, and then you have the presentation that the user would see. You use a model view controller, you could work that out, but it's still it's complicated. Mm-hmm. As an architect, I'd much rather have something that's, you know, got the one feed in it, even though micro formats have their limitations and their strengths and weaknesses. But I'm going to send you a link to the recipe micro format.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, let me check that out.
And it would be neat to see how many sites actually have that. I don't think it's really taken off.
I haven't seen anything that, I mean, we look for all different types of tagging, and you know, the best things we see are things that are tagged as class ingredients or class directions or class serving size.
But that probably helps.
Well, it really helps us. But it's the vast minority of the sites. At most sites, you don't get that lucky. So
yeah, and what you're talking about there is that they've named their CSS.
Yep.
You know, something that makes sense.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, not too much of that.
What a novel approach.
BB_1CD, you know.
Like, oh.
That's a great class.
Yeah. So, Andy, let's go ahead and wrap up. Any advice for the audience? Especially, like, I think a lot of people are thinking about doing something entrepreneurial. You know, just kind of wrap up the show with your thoughts in general.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely a challenge to work a full-time day job and work on a side project. But I think the benefit, obviously, having that freedom yourself and really attaching yourself to something they're passionate about. You know, if it's whether it's cooking like it was for myself, or, you know, it's jumping frog contests, or, you know, ultimate fighting, or just some of the
chihuahuas.
Startups I've heard of.
Somebody's
interested in chihuahas.
Go start a site for chihuahuas. People will come.
But, you know, starting it out yourself and really attaching your passion to it is number one. But the great thing, you know, too, and you mentioned this, but the programs like the BizSpark and obviously open source allow you to do a lot of things on the cheap. You know, sites like Rent-A-Coder and Guru that allow you to help find help if you need it. So you can throw an idea out there onto a wall and bounce it off people that maybe have similar thoughts or passions. And you can help find other people that are good collaborators for a project.
I think that's one of the things is that there are people out there doing this. And other than being protective of an idea that is a lot of that's deep intellectual property, I think most people are more than happy to talk to you about how to start a business. And it's really cheap.
It is.
You know, it varies by state and by country or whatever, but, you know, you can get a startup, you know, the official legal side of the thing done for hundreds of dollars. It's not hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right. No, I think it's, you know, Wisconsin, it's $120 to set up your LLC and then you can set up a bank account. That doesn't cost a whole lot these days. And then all you have to do is worry about putting money in it.
Yeah. Well, cool. Andy, thanks for being on The Thirsty Developer.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. For more information, visit thirstydeveloper.com. We'll see you next time.